Okay, please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Bob Dee, from the Connect the Dots Group in Las Vegas, Nevada.
I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say. My name is Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic. And I am sober today only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, that I've accessed through the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, the process of the 12 steps in the Big Book, an ability to remain sponsorable, and a persistent and consistent commitment to pushing myself aside and serving the primary purpose of helping other drunks. And consequently, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering substance since October 31st, 1978. And for that, I owe you my life and probably more importantly, my freedom, because abstinence without freedom from the bondage of self drives some of us either back to drinking or to taking our own lives, as I've seen happen to some wonderful men and women over the years. I have a disease called alcoholism. I didn't know I had it. I've always had it. I'm delighted to be back in Pennsylvania, the state of my birth and corruption. I feel like I'm returning to the scene of the crime. If there's anyone out there I owe amends to, just line up over here. I've made all the amends of everyone I could find to this date. But oddly, people pop up. I had somebody pop up at 17 years sober. Somebody else popped up at about 25 that I'd looked for, couldn't find. So if there's anybody out there that's sitting here listening to my story and all of a sudden thinking, that's the guy that ripped me off. See me after the meeting. There'll be five wannabes that'll say that to make that up. I had this thing called alcoholism. I didn't know I had it, and yet it drove on me and affected me as far back as I can remember. I had it before I ever picked up a drink. I was like a freeze-dried alcoholic waiting for alcohol. I was weird before there was any reason to be weird. I came from a good family. My parents loved me. I was never mistreated as a kid. I shouldn't, if alcoholism had anything to do with the way you're raised, I shouldn't have it. But I was born with an incompleteness. I was born with a yearning that I couldn't identify what it was, but it kind of drove at me. It drove me to be the kid that just seemed to have a hard time to fit with other kids. And it drove me to act a little out and to act a little louder and try to be tougher and anything, hoping that if I act like these kids look, that I'll feel like they look. And I never really measured up much. And I became a pretend guy. I became the guy who pretended he wasn't afraid, and the guy that pretended he was tough, and the guy who pretended he was cool, and the guy who pretended he fit. But I was none of that. I think more than most people, our book says that we live a double life. We have the stage character we want to present to the rest of the world, and then the squirmy, sick feeling inside where we know we're not really any of that. And then the anxiety of being found out. And there's a phoniness to guys like me that we just learned to live with, I suppose. I don't know that I could ever live with it very well, but I was a cover-up guy. And I've been that way before I ever picked up a drink. And when I first found alcohol, an event that would literally change the course of my life, the magic of alcohol on alcoholism is essentially alcohol, and then later years, combinations of alcohol and drugs, was an amazingly effective treatment for what I don't even know is secretly wrong with me, but it's wrong with me. And you don't know that there's even something wrong with you until it's no longer wrong with you. And I remember in the early days of my drinking, I'm a guy who can't talk to people. I'm a guy who seems to be stuck up in my head. I'm a guy who's overwhelmed by squirmy emotions that I don't understand. And I don't see evidence in anyone around me. And I don't fit. And I have this loneliness. And I'd have five or six drinks, and that just would fall off of me. and five or six drinks, and I could come out and play. Five or six drinks, and I could shoot pool better than I could ever shoot pool. I could talk to girls. I can't talk to girls sober. You get me half lit up, I can talk to girls. I remember there was a junior high school, there was a girl I had this crush on. It was so bad, not only couldn't I talk to her, if I was in class with her, I couldn't even look in her direction. I was just like, she made me crazy. And I went to a dance one night, and she's there dancing with her girlfriend. I'm plastered up against the wall of the gymnasium watching her, and I couldn't take it anymore. I had to got out of there, went out in the parking lot with a guy at a pint of 151 rum. Any 151 rum drinkers in here? There is no social drinking of 151 rum. And I drank some. I came back in there under the power of 151 rum. I just walked right up to her with a suave fair beyond me. Walked right up to her, started talking to her. I'm listening to myself. I'm clever. I'm funny. Words are coming out of me. I don't know where they're coming from. It's like I'm having an out-of-body experience listening myself talk to this girl. And I'm thinking inside, I'm going, oh, my God, this is going to work. This is amazing. Like I was channeling somebody or something. Alcohol was fantastic. But the problem is I always end up sobering up. And when I sober up, I'm back to being me. And I never liked that much, really. I couldn't have told you that, because I hide behind a lot of bluster and bravado. But the real truth is, I don't really like being back to me, because I don't fit too good. I don't know how to change the way I feel. I don't know how to come out and play and be a part of the way other people seem to be so easily. And so I drink every single chance I can get. I started getting into a lot of trouble. I don't know that I have alcoholism. I just think there's a lot of snitches out there is what I really think. And I'm getting in a lot of trouble, and I'm getting in a lot of trouble because there's something wrong with me. And I don't know what it is, but every time I go out to party with my buddies, I just have this inability to shut her down when you should. I can't find my party off switch. I mean, I can't find it. It's not there. So I just don't get drunk. I get drunk. When I'm drunk, there's some stuff seems like a good idea. It's not a good idea. And so I'm in a lot of trouble, and I don't know that it's because of a disease called alcoholism. You could have put me in a lie detector in those days and asked me, Bob, is there any way in the world you could possibly be alcoholic? I would have said absolutely not, and I bet you it would have said I was telling the truth. See, I had people in my family. I had a couple uncles who were alcoholics, and I hated them, and I was hell-bent not to be like those guys. Our book says most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. I'd rather be a drug addict. I'd rather be a mental health case. I'd rather be a criminal or a convict. I'd rather be just about anything, but I don't want to be an alcoholic. And the problem with that is people who argue with the truth get sick. And I had alcoholism. And it doesn't matter if you can not have it, and you can have it and try to believe you don't have it, but if you got it anyway, and I had it. And I didn't know I had it. And every time I'd start, I couldn't stop. And I went through a little soiree into drugs for a number of years because I was in so much trouble. By the time I was 16 years old, I'd been sent away for the first time. And I was in so much trouble through drinking because I couldn't control it. Now, I don't want to stop partying. I just want to stop getting in trouble. And some guys introduced me to drugs, but, God, I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics shouldn't do drugs. It's bad. I do them alcoholically, and I just, I whack myself with that stuff. I get old heads that have been doing that stuff for years would say things to me, like, you better cool it, kid. But I can't. I don't have an off switch, and I went through my dance of death with that and everything there was. I just went from one thing to another. I just burn it out and go to the next thing and methadone and on and on and on and on. And eventually full circle back to the last several years, I, my whole life seemed to get reduced down to the most amount of let's blot Bob out for the least amount of money. I drank a lot of Richard's Wild Irish Rose. I drank a lot of the cheapest vodka that you could get. And it was just, I'd just go into a liquor store and do the math. You know, I don't care about. I was with some guy one night. He had a bottle of something I'd never heard of. Actually tasted pretty good. It's called Grand Marnier. He said, wow, that's kind of cool. We drank the whole bottle. That's cool. Let's go get another one. He told me what it cost. I said, are you out of your mind? We could have bought a whole case of wine for what you paid for that. Are you stupid? I mean, but it was really good. It's not about really good. It's about effect. Right? I know that's all I care about. I mean, it's all medicine for me by now. And I'm in that stage the last few years. I couldn't understand what had happened to me. I drink and I'm depressed. I drink and I feel sorry for myself. I drink and there's this God-awful loneliness. And how does this happen? Because I used to drink and it was amazing. It was amazing. And now I drink in this self-pity. I feel horrible all the time. I just blot myself out as much as I can, but I always come to again. And over the years, I started doing more and more things to compromise the way I felt about myself. And I over the years, if you're like me, the things that at one time in your life you would have never done because you had some principles and some morals. And then as the years go by, you look back and you're doing them. You're doing them. Some of them become a way of life. And it just eats away at how you feel about yourself. And until some guys like me get to a point where we hate ourselves. And it's hard to change or save your own life when you secretly hate yourself. And I didn't know what was happening to me. I went to some great therapists. I went to a lot of treatment centers. I was just talking to a gal before the meeting. I primal screamed. I was hypnotized one time by a psychiatrist and regressed back into my childhood because even though I had what was seemingly a loving childhood, I suspected that someone must have damaged me because I felt damaged. And I wanted to hang it on somebody. Somebody must have did this to me. And I know my parents were loving and they sacrificed for me and all that stuff. But they must have, maybe they mispotty trained me or something. Something happened to me back then. I got regressed into my childhood trying to uncover that, whatever that thing was. There had to have been some kind of defining instant in my life where I got weird because I've been weird for a long time. And I never found out what it was. Because it didn't happen to me, it happened through me. I think Carl Jung nailed this disease when he said to Bill Wilson in a letter that after working with Roland Hazard and countless other alcoholics, that he came to the conclusion that my thirst for alcohol and yours, if you're a chronic alcoholic, isn't really a thirst for alcohol. It's a misinterpreted yearning and thirst for wholeness and connectedness, or if you're more religiously minded, a union with God. Something in me that I never understood yearned for a homecoming, and I didn't know it. I have never been on my way to a drug dealer's house or a bar or to get laid or to gratify myself by buying stuff and driven in the middle of that stop and said to myself, this is probably a real yearning for God. Never occurred to me. That never occurred to me once. Never occurred. Whatever I think it is, that's what it is. You know what I'm saying? And I sponsor a lot of guys. And there's a phase guys go through when they're about, especially single guys, they're about 90 days sober. The fog's clear just enough. And all of a sudden they realize they got this relationship-shaped hole inside them. And if we're real lucky, we throw them into a lot of 12-step work. And they get through it before they add to their 8-step list, as some of us do. But I didn't know what was going on with me, what was wrong with me. And I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in institutions when I was 19 or 20 years old. I wasn't even old enough to take a legal drink. And I'm being sent to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was in a treatment center for drug addiction. And of all the people there, they only singled out two people out of probably 30, 40 guys and made us go to AA meetings. And I was one of the ones they singled out. And the reason they singled it out, even though I would have sworn to you that's not my problem, one of the counselors there had seen me drink. And he saw the phenomenon of craving. He saw the definitive characteristic that makes me alcoholic, regardless of what I imagine my drug of choice is to be. That I had the allergic reaction to alcohol that only occurs in alcoholics, that I'm the guy that when I start, I can't stop. That's always been true for me. I have never once in all the years I party, ever once been in a bar doing lines, drinking shots, beers, had the bartender say, "Hey, Bob, ready for another one?" I've never had the experience of sitting there thinking, "No, this is good. Thank you. I'm good." Never once. So it was one more. And I always had that. Now, sometimes I'd turn left and go knock on some guy's door and buy something else. But once I started drinking, I was overcome with an irresistible yearning to get higher. I've always had that. I've never not had that. Do you know that that only occurs in people with alcoholism? It doesn't occur in people who are just drug addicts. As we saw, those of you that are old enough to remember this, after Vietnam, we saw thousands of guys come back from Southeast Asia with mega heroin addictions. You know, some of those guys to this day, even though clinically by every definition they were drug addict, can have a beer once in a while. And they're not compelled to steal their neighbor's TV sets or burn their life to the ground or nothing. And I have alcoholism. And I didn't know it. This is a funny disease. It's a disease of self-delusion. And what that is it's a psychotic, wishful thinking. Your reality may very well be like my reality was the last couple years I drank, is that this stuff is turned on you. And it is not a party anymore. It's pathetic. Maybe once you start getting high, you stop bathing. Maybe once you start getting high, you start feeling sorry for yourself or holing up somewhere alone, and yet you feel you're treating your loneliness with isolation because you can't be around people. And it's sometimes you go and cry in jags if you're like me and you feel sorry for yourself. This is not fun. It's pathetic. And this is how this disease, it's the only disease I know of that if you have it, it will use your own mind against you. You get me 7 or 8 months sober, and I will start to imagine and believe that it's true that I can party again like I did when I was 18 years old. And I will imagine that in the face of overwhelming personal experience that's been a dead horse for years. But my God, I don't want it to be a dead horse. I need that and yearn for that effect so desperately, I imagine that it's there when it's not there until I play the game of let's bet your life. And I will put my whole life on the table chasing something that I won't even be able to catch. And that's how this disease takes guys like me and makes fools out of us and punks us out time and time and time again as I burn my life to the ground chasing something I can't even catch. If I could have caught it, I mean, if I could have got an hour or two of fun and being lit up and playing in a band and rocking and rolling and in exchange for some trips to jail and a little bit of homelessness, I think in my alcohol logic, it might have been a good deal. But it's hard to do those equations when you start drinking and it's pathetic and then you get the consequences. It's almost like in the last couple of years you're paying high rent on a house that had burnt down 2 years ago, right? It's awful, and I don't know what's wrong with me, but I don't believe it's alcoholism. And I know that alcohol's in the equation. The last couple of years, it's not that I wouldn't have done drugs. I'd do whatever you got, but for the most part, I just drank cheap wine and cheap vodka. And I know alcoholism is in the picture of my problems, but I am not alcoholic. And I know I'm not alcoholic because by this time I've gone to 150, 200 AA meetings. I've watched you. I've listened to you. I know what happens to alcoholics when they quit drinking. My God, you become grateful for everything. I mean, I don't even like nothing. You know what I mean? I got this malcontent in me. No matter what I bring into my life, the shine of it wears off so quickly and lets me down. I mean, you guys are grateful for everything. And you love everybody. Oh, my God. I don't even like anybody. I don't like me, for God's sakes. These people in AA come with, if no one's told you they love you today, let me tell you I love you. Would you love me after I hit you? I mean, you know, I just make me crazy. I mean, what? So I started. I realized that even though you people were very nice to me, and you were, you'd give me cigarettes, you'd give me rides, a couple of you gave me jobs. You tried to help me, and you were nice to me. I knew that, and I liked that. But I knew whatever's wrong with me is not the same thing that's wrong with you. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And I've been to the psychiatrist. I've been diagnosed a lot of different things. I was diagnosed as clinically depressed by a very competent psychiatrist. But I'm telling you, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I know it like I'm standing here. It was a misdiagnosis. And you know how I know that? Is that I took the treatment and the medication for clinical depression. It didn't help. It put me in a sort of, it gave me a little bit of relief for a little while for my emotions. And eventually the little bit of relief wasn't enough. And I eventually went back to drinking because I felt kind of stuck. I've been diagnosed as free-floating anxiety and panic disorder. And I didn't know that all of this stuff was symptomatic of a disease called alcoholism. And the reason I know that it was a misdiagnosis, the reason I know that it wasn't clinical depression, it was spiritual depression, is because from the moment I started to apply the solution to the spiritual malady of alcoholism, I started to get better. Bill Wilson's experience in the book is exactly like mine. Bill Wilson was a depressive alcoholic, but he found something that logically does not make any sense. When you feel bad, that he could go down to the detox and set himself and his personal problems aside and spend 2 or 3 hours with some guy shaking it out who's coming apart at the seams, who feels like he's dying, and be miraculously freed and uplifted. He says it was a design for living that works. And it has worked for me for 32 and a half years. I've taken no medications. I haven't had a bout of depression in 32 and a half years except for one time. And oddly enough, it was when I was 19 years sober. And I had everything a person could ever want. I was making almost, one year I made 7 figures. I had 3 automobiles that were brand new I bought that were cost more than most people's homes. I wore a watch that cost more than most people's homes. I had more of everything. I ran out of things to buy, and I sank into a deep depression. And you know why? Because I had been seduced by the very fruits of practicing spiritual principles in the workplace and the success I reaped from that into the center of my life. And I didn't even know it. I'd been pulled away from my primary purpose. And a guy in an AA meeting, and I'm in this funk, awful, awful funk. I could hardly get to the meeting. I was so depressed. I don't just get depressed. I get depressed alcoholically. I mean, I get into it. I mean, I get 1,000 pounds, can't get off the sofa. I mean, my hair's depressed. Everything's depressed. I get into it. I drink of depression like I drank of alcohol. And this guy shuffled into this meeting. I'm telling this guy, this feels awful. And he says to me, he says, yeah. He says, I've been watching you. You go to meetings. try to take credit for all these people you sponsor. Run your mouth a lot in AA, don't you? He says, I don't think your primary purpose is helping other drunks. I think your primary purpose is you. And it could have hit me with a 2x4. They say the truth will set you free. It kind of ruins your day first, though. I was like, ouch, because it was right. And I don't know how that happened. I don't know how I went from the guy who went to detox a couple times a week and was on fire, who believed in my heart that I'd been saved from an alcoholic death for one reason and one reason only, and that was to help guys like me. How I could be seduced away from the primary purpose back into me. And when it says in our book that selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our troubles, I'm telling you it is. It is the deal. See, what happens to guys like me that have this spiritual malady is when I quit drinking, I just get my emotions and my life and my future and my past just on me. Like that creature in the movie Alien that just attaches itself to your face. And what happens is emotionally, I start feeling smothered. I start feeling locked up. It's like my spirit is being smothered and depressed because I got so much of me on me, it's killing me. I'm so narcissistically and obsessively self-absorbed and self-focused. And I could be that way when I was drinking and in the early days of drinking and get a little bit of freedom because I'd have 3 or 4 drinks and I'd get free. But alcohol doesn't work for guys like me after a while. And the medications don't work. And I go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love the service commitments I made in AA and the meetings. But if you have chronic alcoholism as I do, and all you do is not drink and go to some meetings, I'm telling you, somewhere inside you in a way that you can't identify, you will start to get worse. And it's vague, and it's slippery, and it sneaks up on you. And what happens to a lot of guys like me is we start to want to leave AA because you're not getting anything anymore. The shine of being the guy who identifies with people and feels like, oh, I have a family now, that kind of wears off after a while, because after you're here for a while, you start realizing these people are idiots. I mean, you know what I mean? And that isn't that the number one symptom of untreated alcoholism, the resurgence of the ego? It's like, I'm okay, but I can see very clearly how stupid people are. I can measure my distance from surrender and spiritual well-being by the amount of judgments in my life, by the amount of opinions. I've watched men and women die of alcoholism, and they don't just die. It's a slow unravel. You don't get 10, 15, 20, 30 years of sobriety and just leave AA. It's incremental, and it's subtle, and it's slow. And you don't just tear down a life that you've built over a couple decades here overnight. You tear it down one brick at a time. And it starts with going to your home group and just noticing the people that had 4 cups of coffee and didn't put any money in the basket. And the 13 steppers, man, somebody ought to castrate them. That's because they're getting more action than I am. But we don't tell ourselves that part, do we? No. And it starts like that, right? Until I'm the only guy I listen to in AA anymore. If I can push enough of you away by judgment, then my disease got me right where it wants me. Right where I want it. And it clamors at you, doesn't it? It clamors at you. There, it's always there. It's always whispering. It's always there. I was with someone last year at an AA event that told me something that really brought a lot of light into some areas of my life. And this person was a biblical scholar, and I'm not a religious guy. It's funny though. You work the steps, and they all kind of look cool. You don't work the steps; they all look kind of weird. But this person said something I'd never heard. She said that in Genesis, if you go back to the Aramaic, or maybe it was the Hebrew, whatever it was originally written in, and in the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden with the serpent, the actual translation, the actual word they use is not the word for serpent. It's the word for the sound that the serpent makes. And that's, you can hear it, can't you? Slithering through the tall grass, can't you? It hisses at you. It chatters. On a good spiritual hair day, it's vague and distant, like music in a doctor's office. I start slipping back into myself and it gets right here. When I get spiritually sick, I reverse my relationship with reality. Spiritually well people, and I don't mean perfect, but that I'm okay, I'm right with me, right with you, right with God, I'm in good shape, is that the clamor is distant, because where I really am is I'm here. I am here. And I'm watching what's going on around me, and I'm listening. I can hear what people are saying in meetings. I sit there and nod my head. I make the connections. I'm thinking, oh my God, I just like that. I'm part of and connected and plugged into the present. I get spiritually sick, and what happens in reality and what is shared in the meeting starts to become like music in the doctor's office, because the big show's on the inside. And I become so internally focused, I'm disassociated from life itself. And then my spirit starts to get depressed and sick and withdrawn from life. We all seem to have a very common experience with untreated alcoholism. You could put it in a lot of different words, but it kind of feels like somebody stepped on the oxygen hose to your being. That's why when an alcoholic's over 2 years or 2 months of untreated alcoholism and the anxiety and depression and obsessive self-involvement of that picks up a first drink, what's the first thing we all do? We all go, somebody turned the air back on. It's almost because I feel stifled. Oddly enough, the word spirit means in the Latin breath of life. Isn't it funny that we would try to treat a spiritual malady with spirits? Makes kind of sense, I guess. And I don't know what so I don't think it's alcoholism. In 1977, I went to a meet. I was locked up. I was facing 2 years in a state penitentiary. And it was a horrible time in my life. The last couple years were awful bleak. When they gave me my phone call, there was nobody to call. And I had once had a family that would have mortgaged their house, would have done anything to help me. They will have nothing to do with me. I had a kid sister that would have done anything to help her big brother. She will not take my calls. I'd been in bands with guys that were, we were like this, that would have done anything for me. They will have nothing to do with me. I had no more girlfriends. I had no more running partners. I'd used them all up. And I get a phone call and there's nobody to call. And I don't know what to do, so I sign up on a piece of paper to go to an AA meeting, not for recovery, because I knew you didn't have any, you were nice people, but you don't got anything for me, because what's wrong with me is not what's wrong with you. God knows, I don't know what's wrong with me. I've been to the psychiatrist, nobody really knows, but I know it's not alcoholism. I went to the AA meeting for cigarettes. Truth. I knew the people in AA would have some store-bought cigarettes. And I was getting low on my bag of Bull Durham that they gave the charity cases in the county. If you've ever smoked Bull Durham, it's a step below cockroach droppings. I'm telling you, it's bad stuff. And I just wanted a cigarette so bad. And I go to this AA meeting, and I'm in this AA meeting, and this guy is bringing the meeting in with a couple of his minions, who I know. His name's Woody, and I know Woody from Gateway. He used to bring meetings in there. He used to bring meetings into Amica's house and a bunch of places, St. Francis and St. John's. And there's Woody, and he's one of those AA do-gooders. He's one of those grateful for everything. Carries a book under his arm like some kind of preacher. You know what I mean? One of those guys that's all teeth and hands and glad to see you. You know, one of those kind of guys. Oh, man. Oh, creepy kind of guy. Creepy. Intrusive. One of those guys that asks you these awful questions like, how you doing? Oh. You got 5 hours? I mean, whoo. I just locked up the answer to that so overwhelming. I mean, how you doing? I don't know what to tell. I'm just fine. I don't know what to say. And he comes in and he's glad to see me in jail. I wonder what he'd think if I was dying in a cancer ward. I mean, he's glad to see me. And I talks about helping people. And I know he has a lot of money. He's got, drives a new Cadillac. Got a big house. He has a big, he's a boss, big job. He's a boss at the steel mill. And so he wants to help. So I needed him to put his house up so I can get out on bail. And I got to tell you something. These AA people are hypocrites. They say they want to help until you explain it to them. And instead, he wants to give me a book and help me with some stairs or something. I don't know. I don't want a book. I want out of here. I need a drink is what I really need. You want to help me? I need a drink. And I get really mad at him and I start telling him about, I don't need your help. I'm going to get out of here and I'm going to beat this. I told him at one point that I was going to get that Voc rehab money and go to college and I was going to be a doctor. And he starts laughing at me. I got hair down to about here. I got sores because I don't eat. You know, I got tremors. I got a beard that's about down to here, untrimmed. I think I fancied myself a ZZ Top tryout or something. I don't know. And he says, you're not going to do any of that, kid, because you haven't hit bottom. You haven't surrendered. And I don't say nothing to him, but I just went in that meeting and sat down and glared at him for the rest of that meeting. I remember thinking, haven't hit bottom. You don't know nothing about me, Woody. When I got in here, they gave me a phone call, and I don't have anybody to call. I'm dying here. You don't know, haven't hit bottom. Haven't surrendered. Haven't surrendered what? I remember thinking that. Surrendered what? What do you want, for God's sakes? There's nothing left of me. A couple years ago, I had a guitar. I had a girlfriend. I had a good job. I had a Harley at one time. I don't have anything. I think a couple years ago, I might have even had maybe a little self-respect, but it's all gone. Surrender what? And Woody's talking about the one thing, and there'll be people in this room that will die because they can't surrender the one thing. And some guys surrender it in $5 million homes and change their life dramatically, and other guys will go all the way down to living in the bushes, and they still can't give it up, and they will choke to death in their own vomit, and they still can't give it up. And that is the will. It's the first thing that we address in the third step. We give up the will. And what is the will? Well, what Woody saw when he looked at me, and he'd seen me in all these institutions, is he saw a man who was dying pathetically from alcoholism, and yet insisting at being at the helm of his own ship, in spite of the painful reality that I'm redestroying myself and redestroying myself over and over again. But I don't know that I'm doing that. Because when I'm scared and inadequate, it is natural for me to try to control and figure and think. There's a line in our book that says the alcoholic's problem lies mainly in his mind. And oh, my God, that's bad news. Oh, because I don't know about you guys. When I'm in distress or depressed or fear or things are coming at me, what do I want to do? I want to think. I'm a thinker, man. I'm not a doer, but I'm a thinker. And I'm retreating to the source of my problem for an answer. I'd be better off getting Charles Manson as a spiritual advisor than listening to my head. But it doesn't look that way to me. See, because I got the ego. The ego of the alcoholic is amazing for guys like me. I heard a guy say it 30-some years ago. We're egomaniacs with inferiority complexes. It's not so much I'm a piece of whale crap. I'm a very special piece of whale crap. I'm the guy that lays in the gutter and looks down on people. I'm the guy. You can't help me because I don't listen to anybody except me. I'm that self-reliant and self-willed. And I'm dying. And I, through a series of circumstances, I get sentenced to 2 years in a state penitentiary. The commitment was stayed. I was put into a place called the Ark House. I hate to call it a treatment center. It was the bottom of the food chain for treatment. They housed a couple hundred guys off the winos off the streets and guys out of prison and rooms with bunk beds, tons of bunk beds, and it was the bottom of the food chain. And I was in this place, and I'm trying to stay sober. I don't want to do the 2 years in prison. I don't want to do it. I don't jail well. It's turned on me. I can't get high right anymore, and I'm starting to know that. And it's a horrible thing to know, because if there's no ease and comfort in the bag and the bottle, it's almost a feeling like, why should I even go on living anymore? You mean the way I feel here in this halfway house is the best I'm going to feel the rest of my life? I remember going up to a guy in AA one time. I've been sober several months, and I was in this place up in Newcastle. And I just felt so, I was depressed and lonely and bored. Bored. Just bored, overwhelmingly bored. And I said this whole time, I said, you know, you've been sober for a while. For God's sakes, what do you guys do for fun now that you don't drink? Oh, he gets a big smile. He says, oh, we go to a lot of meetings. Oh, shit. Oh, no. I didn't want to say anything. You know, I said, oh, because I know you people are very big on meetings. Oh, meetings, good, good, good meetings. I said, but, you got to do something else. He said, oh, yeah. Twice a year, we have an AA dance. I've been to AA dances. I'll tell you something. It reminds you of why you used to drink. Oh, they're horrible. Oh, they put me in the van of losers and drive me to the AA dance where, now, I got clothes on that came out of the clothes bag in the halfway house. So I got check pants, check shirts, the checks don't match, right? I walk in there, I stand up against the back wall with a feeling like it's all of you. And then there's me. And I thought, to me, AA's got good news and bad news. The good news is, well, maybe if I went to thousands of these tediously stupid meetings, then maybe I'd stay sober the rest of my life. And the bad news, I'm going to live a long time. I can't imagine life like this. I can't. It's beyond feeling like I'm doing time. It's horrible. I pick up a drink in the Ark House because I can't stay sober. I play the game of Let's Bet Your Life. I'm on paper. I'm going to do 2 years in prison. I just can't take it anymore. I took a shot. I got caught. Got thrown out. A couple days later, I come to in the park, and I'm so sick. The progressiveness, there's a physical progression in alcoholism in addition to the emotional and egotistical progression. And I just a couple days into a run, I'd have the tremors already. And I'm in the park, and I'm shaking, and I just came to, and I feel so pathetic. And a doctor that previous year in a detox had given me a complete physical because I thought that I had a brain tumor. Well, it would have explained a lot. I didn't have a brain tumor. After the physical, he said to me, I was in my 20s. He said, well, kid, you're young enough and you bounce back pretty good because you're young. You'd probably go on like this for another 5 years before it kills you. I thought, I'm in this park. And I thought, 5 more years of this. Oh, my God. I can't do 5 more days of this. I want out. And I don't know how to kill myself. I want to kill myself. If I could get a gun, the problem about getting a gun is that a cheap gun in a pawn shop is about $100. Well, every time I'll get $5 or $10 towards the $100, I got to go get on. So I'll never get $100. So I decide to jump off a bridge, and I get to the bridge, and I'm perched up on the side of it, ready to kill myself, and I start crying. I'm not afraid to die. What I'm really afraid of is I'm probably going to screw this up like I've screwed up everything else in my life, and I won't die, and I'll end up paralyzed from the neck down in some charity ward, and I'll be there for 50 years as members of AA that I don't even like bring their newcomers through the hospital room, and I'll get to hear them say, "This is what happens to you when you don't find God and work our wonderful 12 steps." And I'll be paralyzed. I won't even be able to give them the one-finger salute. And I broke down and started sobbing. I can't even tell you how pathetic I felt. I can't even kill myself. I can't even kill myself. And little did I know that I would come off that drunk and enter into the only good life I've ever known. I came off that drunk 2,000 miles away in a hospital in Las Vegas, Nevada. The Buddhists say when the student's ready, the teachers appear. And they started coming out of the woodwork. I'm telling you, I had God works through people. Because he can't work through me because I ain't nothing in here. But he worked through people. And it started to change my life because I was broken enough. And I had enough of me kicked out of me that for the first time in my life, I was sponsorable. I don't mean to placate the concept. I mean when they told me to do things I didn't agree with, that felt very uncomfortable and were threatening to me, I did them. Like turn myself in to the courts in Pennsylvania and offer to do the 2 years. And endless things like that. And I started finding out amazingly that nothing they were having me do hurt me. Nothing. And I told my sponsor in early sobriety, I'm going to do everything you tell me to do. But if you screw me up, I'm going to tell everybody. And nothing I've been asked to do here, everything I've been asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous has changed my life for the better. I was fairly new and I went to a meeting. And a guy named Joe cornered me after the meeting and he said to me, he said, kid, I listened to you in the meeting. You need to take the third step. And I'm looking at the 12 steps on the wall of the Alano Club, and I read the third step, and I said to Joe, I can't take the third step. He says, why not? I said, Joe, I'm praying, but the truth is I don't believe in God. I mean, there might be a God. I don't know. I'm praying, but because they told me to, but I don't know if there's a God or not. And Joe said, you don't have to believe in God to take step three. I said, but Joe, that's what it says. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I don't understand God. I don't even know if there is a God. He says, listen, kid. And he points to a chair in the Alano Club. He says, I promise you, if you'll turn your will and your life over to this chair, an instant miracle. And I thought, what the heck? Okay, Joe, I turn my will and my life over to the chair. What's the miracle? And he says, oh, the miracle is your life would no longer be in the hands of an idiot. I didn't even get mad. I just thought, yeah, that'd be right. Because if you'd have followed me around and watched me, maybe as your loved ones and friends have watched you, they've come to the conclusion, whoever's making decisions for this person is out to destroy them. Yet it never looks that way in here because of my ability to justify and rationalize. God sent me a guy named Dale who died with cancer with a lot of years of sobriety. He was a wonderful, wonderful man. Gruff guy, but funny. Had that light in his eyes. And Dale came up to me after a meeting one time. He says, listen, kid, I'm going to tell you some stuff. If you buy it, it's going to save you a lot of pain, a lot of grief. He says, kid, I want you to know if you're explaining something, if you're defending something, if you're rationalizing something or justifying something, kid, I want you to know you're wrong. Because you never have to defend, explain, justify, or rationalize what's right. That was over 30 years ago. To this day, that has been true. The justification, rationalization is just the squirming. It's the slithering of the snake as it tries to justify the self-gratification and the self-defense and the self-righteousness. You know the problem with self-righteousness? Self. And Alcoholics Anonymous has entered me into a life of self-abandonment and service. I'm sober a while. I still go to 8 meetings a week. I have 3 commitments every week now at places of recuperation, 2 at the West Care Detox and 1 at a men's halfway house Wednesday nights. And I don't tell you that to grandize me. I tell you that because I hope in hearing that, 1 or 2 of you will get up off your butt and go do something here. The doers get it all here. There's 2 groups in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's those who do and those who judge. The judgers are too busy judging to do much, and the doers are too busy doing to judge much. Stay away from the judgers and join the doers. You will be judged. But live your life on principles. You know, I was sober a long time before I understood the 12th tradition where it says principles before personalities. You know what I thought that meant? I thought that I had to put the principles of love and tolerance and acceptance and all that stuff in AA ahead before your apparently very flawed and screwed up personalities. There's only one personality I have to put these principles before, and it's mine. I am the seat and center of all my separation, judgment, and conflict. I am the guy who has to live by the principles, or else I'm going to live by self. I tell you something, I believe with everything in me that those of us that have this malady are compelled to serve something. I don't think I have a choice. And I'm either going to serve this ethic and these set of principles and this primary purpose of helping other people and ultimately a power greater than myself, or I am going to serve myself. And I did that for a lot of years. And it doesn't work. And so I tried to put these principles of Alcoholics Anonymous ahead of myself. A lot of times they're very inconvenient. A lot of times saying yes to AA really is what Bill Wilson says, that it is necessary to perfect and enlarge my spiritual life. It's not through prayer and meditation. Bill says it's through self-sacrifice and constant work with others. So when somebody asks me to come to Quakertown or Bakersfield, California, or to go down and listen to a fifth step or take a meeting into the detox or be on a convention committee, or I don't have any judgments. I don't say, oh, I don't like that part of AA, or that's poly. I just say yes. I just say yes. Because you know what I think? I think if one of you is asking me to do something, I think God's behind the curtain. And I just say yes. I mean, I don't want a self-directed life. And so I let God lead. And He leads through the people in AA. And He leads through the roadsides. I don't always know what God's will is, but I always know what it's not. And so I let Him lead. And He leads through my emotions. Emotions that at times make me very uncomfortable, that I used to want to run to medicate or drink over. And those are God's way of telling you, turn left. Yeah, but I want to go right. He said, you're going right and you're depressed, aren't you? Yeah, but I think it's better over here. No, He's trying to tell you, turn left. Right? I want to shut it off so I can go right, do what I want to do, right? And I try to let Him lead. And my life is very good today. I attribute that to the fact that I'm diligent at trying to keep it out of the hands of the idiot. Thank you for listening.